IVM. Hello and welcome to the Ganatantra podcast. I am Sariu Natarajan.
And I'm Alok Prasannakumar.
And welcome to this week's episode, which is the season ender for season two. What we hope to discuss in this episode is to talk a little bit about what we've explored in this season in the context of COVID-19. And part of the reason we've come here to do a season ender episode is because we as Ganatantra, and Alok jump in here, is for us to be able to take some time off to think about where we want to take this podcast and raise a few questions to ourselves about what we should be interrogating as Ganatantra in the seasons to come.
Yeah, that's right, Sariu. And I think this is the 30th episode of the season. And we started in September of last year, which might as well have been a decade ago. It feels like so long ago and so far back in time that I can barely remember it in the midst of time. I remember we started recording this in the IVM studios with Dr. Gopal Guru and
Dr.
Smitana Saikia, who joined us in the studio. And it just feels like so long ago. But no, I think we have done about, this is the 30th episode of the season. And I think we have covered, and as we had planned, we've covered, for those of you who wanted to hear back our first episode of the season, we've covered almost all the ground that we intended to. And as we were just talking about it, I think it has given us a lot of insights that we sort of want to leave our listeners with, you know, in light of what we are seeing happening in COVID and during the COVID-19 crisis, and maybe a way to make sense of what might happen in the coming days.
Yes, indeed. And we want to pick up on the themes that we've talked about this season, which is marginality and marginalization, institutions and state union relations, which is federalism, to understand a little bit more about how these factors influence our understanding of COVID and how the situation plays out. So thinking about marginalization, I think what has been made apparent over the last few days, particularly post the lockdown, has been how important it is to think about marginalized communities in imagining any kind of major country level initiative, whether it is something like a lockdown or something like demonetization, which happened in 2016. Especially given what we've learned over the course of the episodes, I particularly recall Dr. Chinmay Tumbe's episode where he talked about migrants and the impact upon them of large-scale countrywide efforts like this. Migrants are a particularly fragile group of citizens, of residents of this country, who, you know, many of them are internal migrants who come across state borders or even within their own states. Dr. Tumbe explores it excellently in his book, who come across state borders in the hope of livelihood and to do business. And this is a community where the closure of sort of economic activity has a huge and significant impact. And a lot of political movements have been based on the idea of migrants and sons of the soil and related sort of issues. But the idea of movement in the time of lockdown is a bit of a paradox, and that exacerbates the impact on migrant communities.
That's right. And we mentioned this very briefly in our episode last week, where we talked about the fact that the government didn't see these categories of people. And that's really what marginalization means, that the state doesn't see you in a certain way, that the state does not address your needs in a certain way. And the consequences of the lockdown, I don't think will end when the lockdown is lifted. I think what we will see is this play out in a very, for a longer period of term than, say, whenever the lockdown ends. But also, and this is what listeners have to keep in mind, the impact won't be the same forever. I mean, that seems like a very trivial thing to say, but keep in mind that this impact is not just about migrants or daily wage laborers. There are other elements to this. There are elements of social exclusion to this. There are elements of discrimination to this, that there will be those who because of community networks or privilege or background or whatever it is, will be able to be far more resilient about what happens after the lockdown is lifted. But there will be those who are not. And it's the duty of any modern state to be able to take into account the needs of those who are not. And this includes, of course, groups of women on the basis of caste, tribal communities, transgenders, a whole range of communities in India who have been marginalized in various ways and whose life experiences and whose background we sort of covered in the initial few episodes.
Absolutely. And I think another important segment of marginalized to think about are gig workers, but particularly platform gig workers. We're talking about services like Uber, Ola, other services like UrbanClap, which involve a mix of service professionals from across the country as well as from across genders. And to think about the impact of a lockdown on these communities is also vital. Alok and I want to say in October, again, probably 10 years ago, Alok, was an episode that we did.
Yeah.
Was an episode that we did on understanding the margins of work, particularly looking at the platform gig economy. And to think about, like Alok said, the impacts of a state decision and the responsibilities of a modern state in this context is very, very critical. And to think about, you know, how much a lot of this service segment services the aspirations of an elite upper class, and how there's been a complete breakdown in the provision of the services, leading to sort of an interesting conundrum, right? Which is that you have platform gig workers who are considered entrepreneurs, who are not necessarily considered as part of any workforce in that sense, but yet providing an essential service. So the need to recast them or imagine them as a public infrastructure, which Aditi Suri, I don't know if you've seen the piece, Alok, has done in a fantastic piece in The Hindu. We'll try and link it in the notes, but you know, imagining this service professional group as a public infrastructure and what they can do to hold the economy and, you know, keep it going in some senses. And so to think about the lockdown as something that's abstracted from the social reality within which it operates is a bit problematic, and particularly of the social realities of marginalization and invisibilization that operate, it's critical to be cognizant of that. Which is why, you know, one of the things that I noticed, and I'm looking for more information on that, the expert committee that's been constituted at the central level to look at the COVID-19 crisis does not, I think, have a social scientist. And I think that...
That'd be very surprising. Yeah,
that'd be surprising. And there's not very much information about it except a couple of news articles. So hopefully I'm wrong about it. But I think there's something there to think about why society and the way social structures and social conditions operate in the context of each other is critical in thinking about something like a lockdown.
That's right. And that sort of also brings us to the point, and the other half, the other side of this equation is about institutions. Now, we sort of covered a lot of wide-ranging institutions at the central level largely, but it also helps to think about state capacity. Let's see institutions as a way of how state capacity is exercised and how they're able to reach to the last person on the ground. And this ties in with the third part of our series, which is federalism, and in the sense that the government in India only reaches the ground because of the last two tiers of a federal government, your state and municipal and panchayat governments. And we are seeing this pattern, and maybe this will be borne out in a few weeks from now, once we have more complete data, that states which have invested in good public health infrastructure, that have improved their bureaucratic capacities, that have institutions which can work on a certain basis of competence and efficiency and trust, have been able to manage this crisis in a better way. Now, that is at least as far as the health aspect is concerned, because, you know, very initially, about a month or so ago, we had this discussion between ourselves that we are actually facing two crises, right? And a lot of people have written about this also. There is a public health crisis, and there is also an economic crisis coming our way. And I think it's possible that the economic crisis will be much, much more harder to address and resolve than just the public health issue. And in a sense that we may be able to limit the number of deaths, the number of cases, and get the economy going, but will we have an economy that will be going in a few weeks is an open question. And I think that is where the strength of our institutions is really going to be tested.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that one thing to think about, or rather a couple of things to keep in mind in the context of thinking about institutions in the time of a crisis, is a health crisis, for example, requires coordination from several departments. So at least in Bangalore, there's the Brihat Bengaluru Mahanagarapalike, which is the municipal corporation. There is the state police. There are departments of health and family welfare that operate at the state level. And so there is a range of institutions beyond the center coordinating with the state, with the center coordinating with the state itself. So there's sort of a multifariousness about how many sort of institutions come into play in this context. And so to think about how institutional capacity intersects with this need for coordination and this need for coming together. And this is not, and I think we did talk about it in our issue on police reform. This is not to brush aside these concerns around police brutality that we've been hearing about. That is not what this is about at all, but rather the need for different kinds of institutions to come together and how much, as Alok pointed out, state capacity matters. And you can see the differences in that sense in state performances, in state performance. States that have invested in urban infrastructure, that have invested in urban local governance in some sense, thought about capacity at that level, have so far seemed to have handle on the cases, though the exponential curve threatens to take over at any point of time. So to think about institutions without thinking about state capacity is really a problematic way to go ahead.
We've seen, and it's actually kind of interesting because we did an episode on the judiciary, and this is, and I know it sounds classy to be saying this, but we may have gotten some of our biggest strides in judicial reform during this COVID crisis. One of the things that has happened, and only people in the know are sort of keeping track of this, is that overnight our judiciary has moved to teleconference, e-hearings, the use of the much more widespread use of technology in conducting their day-to-day business, and also some sort of sensible cause list management. They did try it initially in the Supreme Court, but I think what is also coming to the fore is our judiciary understanding there are certain urgent cases that we need to address, and there are certain less than urgent cases we need to address. And we may, because of the large-scale release of under trial prisoners, and this may just be a temporary measure, we may have gotten some measure of criminal justice reform also. Again, it remains to be seen whether these gains will be built upon. And there's, of course, much more to be done. But somehow, solutions which were dismissed, solutions which are seen as, no, impractical, not possible, too difficult, why should we, and all of that, are being put into effect in the midst of a crisis. And there is a sense, and now the judges are saying, oh, this works. Yes, of course, there are glitches. Yes, there are problems. But, oh, this works. Important cases are being heard through teleconferencing. There is, of course, a need to improve technology. The court is cognizant of it. But it is now more about working out the modalities rather than taking the first step of putting that infrastructure into place. And it may be that if the lessons are learned correctly, a crisis may have been actually not wasted for a change in this country.
Absolutely. I mean, there's obviously quite a need for testing many of these things out further in terms of their implications on outcomes, in terms of their implications on the system, etc. But having said that, this might be this could have been an email moment for us, for the judiciary. I think there are aspects of the court process which we can recognize, such as relating to cause list management, even some kind of appearances which can be done through technology, which have significant impacts on time, costs, basically the entire system. And this has in some ways proven itself to be an opportunity. And so I think in the moments that I feel certainly hopeful, I do think the way institutions function beyond the questions of interdepartmental coordination or institutional coordination, the way these institutions function could definitely see a radical shift. Particularly through a shift to technologies where presence is required. Basically, this could have been an email.
I think that's probably might change the way some of our institutions function. But one of the things that's going to be put really to the test, and this is again a developing situation, we don't know how this will play out in the next few weeks, it's the money issue. Even between our previous episode and today, we see that a lot of states have announced pay cuts for their employees. I'm not talking about the voluntary pay cuts taken by cabinet ministers and MPs and MLAs and so on. I'm talking about state government and central government employees staring at pay cuts, staring at delays in salaries, and looking at the fact that the seventh pay commission, the assumptions on the basis of which the pay was fixed there, may no longer be true. that not only are we looking at a serious shortfall, a temporary serious shortfall in revenue, but also for the next foreseeable year, serious strain being posed on the finances of state governments. And this brings into the question, will this mean a rethink of how center state finances are handled? Because at the end of the day, and this is a point that a lot of people sometimes forget when we talk about this big giant union government sitting in Delhi, the big giant union government actually cannot do too many things on the ground. It is the state government and it is the municipal and the panchayats which have to actually do things on the ground. That even a census needs state government employees to go around house to house to undertake the census.
Yep.
That whatever efforts are being made to tackle COVID, the bulk of it is actually being done, almost 90-95% of it is being done by state government employees. Different states are trying different strategies and tactics in addressing it. And the center can, of course, coordinate, can issue guidelines and so on. But on the ground, where the rubber meets the road, is the state. And if the state's finances take a hit, this is something that is going to have to be an issue that has to be addressed by the union government. State governments are already saying we don't have enough money. The union government will have to find some ways of getting them money to just basically be able to do their functions. But also perhaps rethink some of the very fundamental arrangements. I think it's been criticized and accepted in different ways. But I think Jairam Ramesh has had something very interesting to say about the move yesterday to suspend MP LADS, the Local Area Development Scheme funds, for a period of 2 years. That's about 7,000 crores. And a consistent critique of this, and a lot of people have made this critique, we can share the links afterwards, is that this MP LADS scheme sort of bypasses state governments, does not relate in any solid outcomes, is simply just a way to curry favor and discretionary spending and so on. But if the center were to say that we are suspending MP LADS, and that's what they have done, but if they were to say we're going to take these 7,000 crores that we're going to save over the next 2 years for MP LADS and give it to states so that they can plan their expenditures, they can come up with the projects needed to survive through this tough economic phase because of COVID, we may have seen a very fundamental rethinking of a lot of the architecture of center-state relations when it comes to money, especially in the context of fiscal federalism. We were in the midst of that debate about how much the center should spend and how much the center should, give to the states. And it's possible that once the center realizes that there's no great use of having a lot of money allocated for defense expenditure if you don't have an economy left, and you will have to go out there to ensure that state governments are able to spend and rebuild the economy at the ground level, it may be that the center gets disabused of this notion that it can centralize spending in this country. So maybe the talk of discussion on fiscal federalism that we had, and finance commission that we had, might get a completely new dimension over the next 1 year, given the kind of stress that COVID and the economic crisis that is going to follow has placed on this relationship.
Yes, and I think this is also a moment for us to mention that to think about the economy or even center-state relations, while it might seem esoteric and it might seem very abstracted from the ground reality, MPLADS were a critical way of distributing patronage, at least in some instances, for the political parties that the MPs belong to. It was a way to support local businesses or whatever else it was. Patronage was diverted in very many ways, and there's a whole lot of writing about how patronage operates on the ground. But it's a way to ensure that you secure vote bases for the next election when the time comes. And so to abstract the discussion around center-state relations, to abstract the discussion around finances without looking at the on-the-ground reality of how money operates for politics is, I think, a bit is something to be kept in mind. So the debate around MPLADS is not likely to be, well, this is the best way to deploy our resources at the moment, but what is it going to do for the MP's political prospects at any point of time? And this is not about a particular political party. Any political party in power sees the funds that are available to the MP and also to the MLA. So every elected representative has a certain discretionary spending budget that they have to allocate to projects of their passion or their interest or their community's need. And so to think about this money as set aside or only really a question of distribution of resources, I think that's potentially problematic and must be avoided.
That's right. And this is also going to the question of money. This is also going to do some interesting things to some of the other institutions that we spoke about. And I think it's briefly worth highlighting the news media. We had this long and very fascinating discussion with Asim Khan on the future of the news media and democracy. And to be fair, the news media has played a fairly stellar role, at least in India, about sort of raising questions of highlighting failures, you know, the whole issue of migrants. And there has also been news media which have played a terrible in simply parroting the government's line and helping distract, raising unnecessary communal issues, communalizing certain issues.
I thought
issues.
The Supreme Court expressly asked for it, Alok.
Well, yes, Supreme Court made the news media work. Well done. No, but I think if you speak to people who run these organizations, who have to keep them going on a day-to-day basis, this is, I think, like a fairly make-or-break moment. That a lot of organizations, media organizations, are going to be put under enormous stress to survive through this phase. This may be like a, I hate to use the word, but an extinction level event, what people talk about in the context of the Earth's history, where you know, mass extinctions drive kill off a lot of species and very few survive. This is something that may happen to the news media, that with the tightening of advertising budgets, that with the tightening of people's purse strings, that with the space dramatically shrinking for competition among news media as a result, we may not see a lot of established media organizations survive. And it's hard to say how the chips will fall. Maybe only the deep-pocketed will survive, but who are the deep-pocketed? A lot of their finances are not the most transparent. Will newspapers survive and will TV fail? Possibly, we don't know. Will online media houses thrive and the others fail? Possibly, we don't know. Will, say, new distribution outlets be created? I mean, thanks to this particular incident, I have discovered Telegram. And I realized that unlike WhatsApp, Telegram allows you to add 200,000 subscribers to a group. Now, that's, if you look at the numbers, that's about 2/5 of the audience of the largest television channels, English television channels in the country. So if there was some smart young entrepreneur who just made quality videos and shared them on a Telegram channel and charged people to be on it, would that be an interesting new media distribution channel that we're not thinking of? And this is going to be such a huge disruption. And it's not true. This is not just for media. But we're talking about it, I suppose, in the context of how important it is as an institution for the future of democracy, how it's played a fundamental role in the way in which public discourse is shaped, and what this particular crisis may portend for its future is something that's still very hazy and could go very bad very quickly.
Absolutely. And I think we are also potentially at a point where we are seeing that the success of a particular model of media might be very divergent from its business model, in the sense that what might be consumed, what might be appealing to a large segment of the population, or might be the best quote-unquote channel for dissemination, might be very, you know, separated or divergent or orthogonal to a valuable business model. So I think we're at that point where we need to think about both in parallel and in some ways to see in what ways they can be brought to merge. And to your point, Alok, there are interesting experiments. If lockdowns are interesting experiments in the way media is sort of disseminating. There's always been community radio, which has relied on a network of community journalists. I think there are examples like 101 Reporters as well as Public, which do interesting experiments with the way news is generated and disseminated. But I think sort of questions will also be around ensuring credibility, ensuring standards, ensuring ethical reporting, because these are all questions that manifest or intersect with different kinds of news media in different ways. So I think these will be the questions for the future in terms of thinking about the crisis. And I think especially one interesting point to me, which is very attractive, is the idea of community journalism. If lockdowns are to continue and we are in a situation where journalists experience difficulties in going out to report the most important stories or the most relevant stories, you are going to have to rely on some kind of network of community journalists. And the way that plays out and intersects with the media is something to think about.
Yeah, that's right. And I think we will see new models possibly prop up. We may see some old models falling apart. And I think these will be, as always, exciting times. One last point, though, and well, we can't really end the discussion on the series wrap up without talking about elections. We've done a few episodes looking back at elections and a lot of them thinking, trying to make sense of election results and so on. But, and maybe this is still, this is jumping the gun a little bit. There is, of course, the U.S. presidential elections, which we're not going to talk about. But in this is a year which, and I think COVID has chosen a very good year to strike India, because not too many major elections are scheduled this year. We are in, except for Bihar, which is happening later this year in November. And early next year, we'll have more elections. And through the course of next year, we'll have more elections. But it'll be interesting to see if this becomes an election issue. And when I say this, I mean both the crises, both COVID-19 and the economic crisis which follows. How much of an election issue will they be? And how will parties pitch themselves in the context of this crisis? Will incumbents tout their credentials? Will they talk about how well they performed or how well they fared? Will the opposition get a stick to beat the ruling parties with to say that this is how you messed up, this is the consequence of all of this? I think this is something that, again, it's hard to see going forward because we're still in the midst of it. But if history is any guide, there was a fascinating article in Mint recently, and I just happened to buy the book, about how the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic, had a fairly significant impact on India's politics. When I say India, I mean, of course, colonial India, pre-independence India, not the modern liberal democratic state. It had a fairly interesting impact on politics, including Gandhi having apparently come down with the flu. And, and even prior to that, Tilak's sedition charges against the way in which the government had managed the 1890s, had managed the epidemic prior to that. So it's worth thinking about. And perhaps when we sort of see how this flu could influence politics, how this particular virus could influence politics, it may also have a significant way in which electoral politics plays out in the next year and a half.
Most certainly. And I think it's both in terms of the electoral issues that come to play as well as the way in which impacts are distributed, particularly if we're coming back to what we discussed in the earlier part of this episode and the earlier part of this season, marginalization, particularly if marginalized groups experience, and as they are, experience magnified effects. This is something that could be a significant component of how electoral issues are arranged and how the arithmetic almost even works out. So again, comes back to the point that I think Alok and I keep trying to make during the podcast, which is that everything is political. It is difficult to abstract politics from social reality and social reality from political arrangements. And I think that is the thought we'd like to leave you with in some ways at the end of season two.
And with that, we have sort of come to the end of our time for this episode. Thank you all for tuning into this season. Thank you all for listening to our episodes, your comments, your feedback, your emails of appreciation, your messages across various platforms, and of course, your honest critiques when needed. This has made us improve, work on the show, improve on it a lot better, think about what content we want to cover, whom we want to invite, and what areas we should be talking about. And given that we, and I think, say honestly, at least for myself, have learned so much, have thought about things very differently in the due to the conversations that we've had with our most excellent and fascinating guests. And thank you once again to every one of our guests who took time out to be on our podcast. Every one of them has given their time freely. They have shared their knowledge, their wisdom, their experience, and their learning with us. And I'm sure all of our listeners have benefited from it. And given that we sort of now want to bring this particular season to a close, we are taking some time off to see what path we want to chart ahead for our podcast. We want to definitely improve. We want to work on a lot more things. And we will see where you can hear us in the future.
Absolutely. And thanks are also due to IVM, who's been a fantastic partner. We've really enjoyed working these two seasons with them. We also want to thank Resonance Studios in Bangalore. They've been a fantastic recording partner. Many of our episodes, the ones that you don't complain about, are the ones that are recorded at Resonance. So a big shout out to Ram and crew over there. Also, a big shout out to the wonderful guests. Like Alok said, this podcast wouldn't have been what it is without having these guests give their time so freely and so generously, their thoughtfulness and kindness, and all of you listeners who've been instrumental in making Ganatantra what it is today.
Yeah. And so on that note, we will take your leave, but we'll be back soon. Do keep an eye out on our social media feeds, and do keep an eye out on when we'll be back. We will announce in what form, shape and manner we'll be back soon. But thank you once again for tuning in, and we hope to connect with you once soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.